Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hi, I'm Phil Craig.
And I'm Andrew Loney.
And together we aim to bring you the most scandalous stories and some of the most scandalous people in history. So thanks for joining us here on the Scandalmongers podcast.
Rollers again, Andrew.
It is. Never out of the news. And a fascinating piece by Richard Kay in Saturday's Mail saying the Royals are at their 11th hour, that the bad PR vice here. They need to be seen to be believed. And there are a lot of unanswered questions, whether that picture was mildly doctored or not. So that's, you know, he's a very respected figure, very well connected. And if he's saying things like that, I think this is a bigger crisis than people realize.
Well,
really, because of the way it's been handled.
In our small way, we've certainly noticed it. And, you know, we promised people more spies, and you will get more spies in this specially adapted longer program. But first, we're going to talk to Valentine, who was our go-to person for royal stuff. But yeah, it's just really very perplexing. All the cancellations and the months away from the camera, then that photograph and the row about that. And it's sort of given people license, certainly outside Britain, to talk about all the rumours there have been about trouble in the royal marriage, William's supposed anger issues. What's Kate really, what's she really suffering from? In this vacuum, there's just so much speculation now.
I mean, it would be very easy, I mean, if she has a colostomy bag, for example, to have just given a recording film, perhaps at a table where she could be sort of discreet, and just say, look, you know, I'm recovering well, thank you for your good wishes. I mean, exactly the sort of thing that the king has done. I mean, I think the thing that I found very odd was when they said that she would be off, William said that he would be caring for her. Now they have a staff, you know, a husband needs to be there, but he doesn't need to give up his royal duties just as his father is ill and giving up royal duties. That seemed a very strange thing to do. Now they say that he's very stubborn, and that he's only working 10 to 4. That may be another problem. People are calling for him to come sooner rather than later, and he may have to because of the king's illness. But I'm not sure he's ready for this job. And she is the linchpin who's been carrying it for years, which is, I think, why everyone is so concerned.
Well, she's certainly been the most popular in all the polls that people do. And we all know that those polls are very carefully read and studied in the various palaces because it's their job to be popular. You know, that's what they're for.
Yeah.
And it's funny. Sorry, Andrew.
Good at it. She's good at it. So, I mean, Valentine is well connected. So, I mean, I hope he'll have some answers to this because I think this speculation just gets wilder and wilder and is not good for them and indeed her own reputation.
Well, we've had a bit of stick on social media and indeed in the comments in the last episode for talking about this stuff. And it's made me think a little bit about why does this matter? Does it matter? You know, should she just be left alone in private? Surely she has the right to privacy when she's clearly not well. You know, I used to be a Republican. When I lived in Australia, I was a member of the Australian Republican movement, I guess for Australia, I would still argue for a republic. It seems mad to have had a state from the other side of the world. But I guess in recent years, my own feelings about the monarchy here have softened a bit, seeing what happened when the Queen died. And just what the work I did on Diana, you know, kind of understanding that they do offer a kind of constitutional stability at a time of great political division.
Absolutely.
And for the Commonwealth too, of course, which is a very diverse institution, but certainly for Britain. And also that they do sprinkle a certain amount of magic on ordinary life, you know, that there's something special about them that we react to, that that speaks to something in it. I wrote about this actually when the Queen died. I might put the link in the bio. But I guess there's a deal that comes with this, isn't there? And it's a deal that Kate Middleton, when she was called Kate Middleton, seemed very much want to take. And the deal is that they're not totally private, you know, that a princely marriage is the brilliant addition of a universal fact, the famous quote, but so is also a princely birth or a princessly birth, and even an illness. You know, it is riveting to us. And their health, their marriage, their children is an important thing to us more than, you know, it is public property in a sense.
Well,
they get a comfy life, they get the movie launches, they get foreign dignitaries, lots of nice things. But in return, we get to kind of see them.
Well, the Queen, you know, I need to be seen to be believed. But yes, they are part of the family. We feel they're part of the family. But absolutely, we're paying for her. And as you say, that's the deal. That, you know, and I think there are important constitutional elements here, because if the King is as ill as people are suggesting, she will be Queen soon. And we need to know that she's, is capable of doing that job.
Yeah.
Both emotionally and physically.
Because if the wheels were to come off that marriage, and if they were to, it wouldn't stop her being Queen. I mean, you know, Diana could have been Queen even had she not divorced. I mean, she'd stay just separated from Charles. But you sort of feel that it might be the last chance. You know, maybe that's what Richard Kay was saying today. If this relationship fails, as so many others have, and in the light of Andrew, and in the light of all the arguments with Harry, maybe republicanism would take off in Britain. I somehow doubt it. I don't know. What do you think?
I don't think so. I mean, I think there's always someone to step up. I mean, we've got Princess Anne, Princess Royal. We've got the Duke of Edinburgh, Prince Edward. I mean, I think there are a lot of good people there who are, you know, playing ball. I think the worry, though, must be, is William playing ball? You know, he has a reputation for being very stubborn and not always as hardworking as he should be, as certainly as his father was. And that's worrying, because he's going to have to carry it.
And the famous Windsor temper, you know, all the work I did on the Charles and Diana relationship. So many people talk about Charles's, you know, furious rages he would fly into. Is William like that? One hears rumours he might be. Is that somehow what's behind this? You know, whatever Kate's going through, is it really purely medical, or is it something else?
Yeah, well, I mean, she doesn't sound like the sort of person who would not be doing her bit if she could. So either it's a very serious illness, or there is some other element here that we don't know about. And I think it is a problem, because in some ways they've been very good so far at maintaining a bit of privacy and mystique, but also this very strong sense of familiarity and caring about people. And I think that whole balance has been changed. Richard Kay makes the interesting point that this is very similar to the days of the Diana and Charles fights. And that was marked by a very weak government that was in its last days. And the government, you know, the Prime Minister didn't step in there, John Major. So I'm not sure it is the role of the Prime Minister, but I think the real problem is that Charles's private secretary, Alderton, is not really perhaps up to the job. He should be knocking some heads together. But we have, you know, two rival houses in effect, Kensington Palace and Buckingham Palace, and each doing their own thing when they should be working in tandem.
Yes, another echo of the Diana Charles thing is that the stories first started to spread abroad. You know, the British press were quite careful until those tapes were published, but lots of things were printed abroad. And of course, that was before the internet. So it took a while for it to come to Britain. Whereas now, you know, a talk show host in America can start talking about the royal marriage and allegations of affairs, starting naming people, women, who, a woman who's been named in America, you know, by a very high profile talk show host. That comes and instantly through Twitter. Instantly, people can see it.
Yeah. And I mean, Tina Brown, who's a respected figure who's appeared on the podcast, you know, a journalist. I mean, she may not be as well connected as Valentine, for example, so we need to hear what he says. But, you know, she's gone public on this.
Yeah, Tina was on ABC, I think, or CBS, one of the big networks, say basically the wheels are coming off. And she didn't really believe the photo was taken. She didn't believe the photo was taken by either Kate or William. She thinks it's some kind of jigsaw assembled by AIDS. I mean, I don't know. That's what she thinks.
Well, I mean, that question has never really been cleared up. And we've been getting quite a lot of flack for suggesting, for thinking that there may be some truth in that. I'm not sure there is, but I think it's certainly worth airing. But I think it's very easy to dismiss some things on social media without really knowing. But it's sort of playing into the sort of our narrative, which is that the royal family needs to be more open if it's to adapt to the modern world and to earn the trust of the nation. And when people fiddle with photographs or keep archives back, that is not a good sign. We've got a case which has appeared in the Mail on Sunday this morning. The fact that the Department of Trade have held back papers on Prince Andrew, they've disappeared, is another point, you know, where it's not the fault of the royal family, but government basically is not being open.
Yeah, well, that's something you know a lot about. All right, well, we've got a lot to cram in now with two interviews and two subjects, so shall we get to Valentine?
Yes. See
what he's heard. All right, let's do it.
Valentine the Third.
Yes, his third appearance, aren't we lucky?
Well, we're thrilled to have Valentine Lowe back for a third time. He's very kindly speaking to us when he's not talking to others. And Valentine, what's going on with Kate?
I wish I knew. I wish anyone knew. It's a big mystery. Ever since she went into hospital for abdominal surgery, people have been speculating and not really getting an answer. And the whole furore of recent days about the photograph of her really was prompted by the questions people have to ask about her health. If you remember, she went into hospital for an operation, abdominal surgery. They wouldn't say exactly what the surgery was for. And then we were told that she'd be recovering at home. We wouldn't see her again until after Easter. It was a long time. And you know, one can understand the palace's reticence, her own reticence about, you know, divulging too many personal medical details. But none of us want our personal medical details and broadcast everywhere, do we? But people will say, where's Kate? And then it got fueled further when William mysteriously didn't show up at the memorial service for his godfather, ex-King Constantine of Greece. This is right at the very last moment. He cited personal reasons, but it was simply not clear why he wasn't going to show. And of course, he was meant to be doing one of the readings at this service. He was actually a player at the service. It was very, very unusual. And the palace wouldn't say any more. So of course people speculate, and it just goes mad on social media. It's all over the American TV as well. Every chat show, every comic is making jokes about, you know, where's Kate? And then this photograph, it was kind of very bizarre. I mean, we've never heard of agencies killing a photograph in such a public way before, particularly not a royal one. And the palace, you know, Kate has apologized. She put her hands up and said it was her who's editing the photograph. But of course, you know, the speculation continues to go mad. Now, I slightly think, I mean, and this is where you and I might differ a bit in our approach. My tendency is to think there's less here than meets the eye. You might well think, Andrew, there's more than meets the eye. I don't know, to be discussed. But, you know, I'm no photographic expert. I've never touched up a photograph in my life. I don't know how to do it. But if you look at all the articles about, you know, what's been touched up in that picture of Kate with her three kids that was released by the palace for Mother's Day, if you look at what's been touched up, it's things like the sleeve on Charlotte's cardigan. It's a zip here. It's a bit of hair there. It sounds as though someone's just trying to improve a photograph rather than some kind of big conspiracy about, oh my God, was Kate not even in the photograph, or, you know, is the entire thing a fake? It looks like little tinkerings rather than anything more major.
Given
people like Tina.
Given the intense scrutiny, as you say, over many weeks, it's built and built. it would be quite easy just to release any old photograph or just to see her waving from a car. But they waited till Mother's Day. Do you think it's really plausible that she herself would be in charge of editing a photograph, knowing how the palace operates? To me, that feels just surprising.
It doesn't feel surprising to me. I think you say she was in charge of editing. I mean, it's normally her who takes the photographs. This time it's William, of course, because she's in the photograph. But, you know, they take the photograph, and I think they just give the final product to the press office to put out. I mean, what conversations go on there? I don't know. But, you know, the photograph is theirs, and they're the ones who tinker with it. You've also the other thing that why I think there's not a big conspiracy here is if the palace is faced with the choice between let's do some grand fake photograph or let's not put out a picture of Mother's Day, it's blindingly obvious what the answer is. You don't put out a picture. You don't need to fake anything. So that's why I think there's less than meets the eye. I think Kate. Slight tendency towards control freakery. I think she wants everything to be perfect and lovely. And of course, William took the picture this time. I mean, I'm surprised he managed to take the lens cap off. He's not known for his photographic skills. She's quite pleased with the photo. She's quite proud of it.
Well, it's good to veer away from conspiracy theories, of course. But the fact that this photograph led them into more trouble, as just as you say, further fueled all the speculation. I mean, we've got major American talk show hosts now talking about the state of the royal marriage, talking about allegations of affairs, and for the first time naming people who are supposed to have had the affair with William sometime in the recent past. Whether that's relevant to this, I don't know. And yet, even now, there's nothing. It would be very easy just to take one picture of Kate smiling from a car. And all we see is they're looking rather sad, being driven in cars. I mean, I don't know, perhaps I'm going too far, but if we opened our laptops tomorrow morning and it said, royal couple to separate, massive headline. How surprised would any of us be, given the events of the last few weeks?
I'd be pretty surprised. I really would. And, you know, this hospital event, she was in hospital. We know that. I think she was seen coming out. No one took photographs, but I mean, I may have got that wrong. But yeah, I think we know for a fact, not just for the palace's word, that she was in hospital. I mean, the palace was very anxious that people should not take pictures of her coming out. They were quite strong on that. I don't think there's any reason to suggest there's anything going wrong with the marriage. I mean, we all know about the rumours about the alleged affair. I don't know whether it took place or not. I slightly think it didn't, but because we've all met 100 people who say, oh, I do actually know for a fact that they had an affair. And then when you question them where they got it from, it all falls apart.
Yeah, it's each other. Yes.
Yeah, exactly. Look, he might have had an affair. Royals have done this in the past, I believe.
Prince of Wales makes a speciality of it. Yes.
I'm not sure. I mean, I remember sometime when the rumours were first flying around, some while later, I was with an engagement with William and Kate in the Lake District, and as part of that, they went to a farm, and they both tried their hands at shearing sheep, and I was standing just 5 feet away from them, and when Kate was having her go, she looked up at William and she gave him a really kind of sort of loving, amused, happy, married look. You know, I mean, yes, you can fake that. Yes, people can still give each other loving looks even when they've strayed. I know all that, but they didn't look to me like a couple then.
Okay. Can I have one more go? Let me have one more go to wind you up and you can pour more cold water on it because we probably need to. Something nobody's much mentioned, this other factor. About 2 or 3 months ago, Kate was effectively called a racist by a book, in a book that seems to have at least the semi-official approval from Montecito. Well, certainly nobody denied it. I mean, Harry and Meghan didn't rush out a statement. Oh, no, we never wanted to say that Kate was prejudiced about colour. I mean, that's a very big thing to say about the future queen of a multiracial society and a multiracial Commonwealth head that she will one day be. Do you think that could have in any way affected the way she's been in the months since?
I think that was a pretty bruising time for her, particularly because, you know, we'd all, we the media, everyone had speculated a lot that it was Charles who'd had the conversation. No one had ever suggested it was Kate. That came as a real surprise. Harry himself has said, no, no one was accusing anyone of racism.
Yeah, in his book he did, didn't he? In his own book he did, yeah.
Well, in television interviews, he said that that conversation about the discussion of the baby's skin was not racist. It may have been he said it was maybe an unconscious bias. He said it wasn't racism.
All right. I'll let him Andrew, you should step in a bit more sober and responsible.
I mean, just for something. Yeah, I'm not completely cold, you know, pouring cold water and everything. You sort of make me sound like a palace stooge, which is the last thing.
Nobody would ever say that.
But I just voicing a note of skepticism.
Sure.
And I don't know the truth about things like affairs and so on. I've no idea.
Who does?
Just my gut instinct is if it is slightly towards no, but who knows? I could easily be proved wrong.
Well, three questions. One is, I mean, are we sure this picture was taken last weekend? Two, why are the American chat shows feeling so emboldened to say the things they are, which they haven't ever done before? And why doesn't the palace, as you say, do something at least to try and dismiss this speculation? In some ways, by remaining silent, they create this vacuum for more speculation.
A lot of questions. As for why the American chat shows are feeling emboldened, I'm not sure I've got an answer for that. I'm not really across American culture. I think they've been pretty bold before, haven't they? And it's now very much open season on Kate, isn't it? You mean they've all gone crazy for Where's Kate? And in that context, they feel no holds are barred. What was your first question again? Sorry, that was
the question about the picture. When was it taken? Because I mean, there's lots
of speculation. When was it taken? Yeah, I mean, I think we're fairly sure it was taken when they said it was. There's a very good piece in the Times which had you know forensic detail about exactly when the picture was taken, what time it was edited. You can see all that from the metadata. So I don't think there's any serious doubt about when it was taken. But you know, again, room for surprise. And your third question again was,
well, why hasn't the palace taken a grip of this story?
Everyone's been saying, why don't they release the original picture? That would be the obvious thing to do. And obviously, prima facie, there's a very good argument for doing that. I think they feel they don't want to create precedents. And if they did that, that would just be more opportunity for people to comment, more opportunity for people to analyze the picture. It would be another 24 or 48 hours coverage. I think they're probably trying to work on the principle of least said, soonest mended. Not working very well for them at the moment, but it's probably also true that anything they do does prolong the coverage.
And do you think this is going to make any change? I mean, is it just a storm in a teacup and nothing will change, or is there going to be less deference, do you think, towards the royal family? I mean, there we've got news agencies, heads of news agencies saying, you know, we're not going to trust anything they give us in future. So do you see this as a point of change?
I think this not trusting anything they give us, there's already a certain amount of scepticism about what they give us. But it doesn't seem to make any difference because there's a lot of what happens a lot of the time is that the palace can supply video footage of events to which the media have not been invited. So they release video footage. And some there's been a lot of complaints about that because the media argues, no, if these engagements take place, the media should be there and the media should be reporting it properly rather than being spoon-fed something that's edited and released by the palace. And sometimes this footage which was released turns out to be not quite what we think it is. I mean, I'm not saying the palace lied, but they created a sort of slightly misleading impression. So it looks something like something that happened in public. It turns out it was for an invited audience, things like that sort of thing. But the problem is, all that happens is that the next time they have a bit of video footage, everyone leaps on it, everyone publishes it. And then sort of 24 hours later, people start to grumble a bit and say, oh, hang on, this wasn't quite what it seemed. So it doesn't make any difference. The skepticism, I'm afraid, always gets put to one side because of the enormous appetite for royal news. And these agencies saying we're going to be very sceptical about any pictures that get released by the palace. Well, yes, that's incredibly... For them to say that is incredibly damaging for the royal family's reputation. And it's really been a bad week or two for the royal family, particularly for Kensington Palace. But, you know, in the end, I don't think it's going to make an awful lot of difference because these agencies, you know, they can look at the pictures, they can give them careful scrutiny and tell if they've been altered or mucked around with. And again, you know, the appetite for raw news means that, you know, when that picture is put out, it will get used. What will happen, of course, is the palace, royal family, the Kensington Palace, will be a lot more careful about what they put out and how in future.
I mean, few people know as much as you, Valentine, about how it works. You know, Valentine's book, for anybody who doesn't know, Courtiers, is completely required reading for anybody with even a passing interest in this subject. But, you know, the balance of power within the palaces and between the palaces. So let's say you get a call tomorrow from BP. It's probably going to happen one day for you, isn't it? Come on, we need your help. We need to sort this out once and for all. Take charge. I mean, do you think Buckingham Palace will be thinking about that? Because, you know, they're effectively, essentially, they're more powerful than KP. Can anybody tell William and Kate what to do? You need to do this. You need to be filmed just with a, you know, with some daffodils or walking the dog. You know, you said that she's quite a control freak. She likes to be very well put together in all her images. But perhaps somebody, a new recruit like yourself, would say, look, you've got to change your public relations effort here. And is that even feasible that could happen?
Yeah, look, the history of palace relations is littered with the bodies of people who've tried to control the different palaces. So, you know, the idea that Buckingham Palace is successfully going to tell Kensington Palace what to do, I think that's one for the birds. That would provoke furious rows. And I think in the end, it wouldn't. We saw this, you know, similar sorts of rows in the 90s, in the Charles and Diana era. We've seen it since then. I mean, They are separate fiefdoms, really. I mean, yes, overall,
Buckingham Palace. And are they stubborn? Do you think William and Kate are just quite stubborn? They won't be told. They just don't want to be told.
Stubborn, yes. William is definitely stubborn. I think, and Kate's pretty steely. And don't forget, William has his own money. It's not like Daddy can turn off the taps. William has got the Duchy of Cornwall money. He's his own
$20 million.
Right. So, I mean, yes, he will listen to what the centre says, but, you know, do not do what headquarters said, because it's not really headquarters.
Right.
Is there a bit of a power game going on here? Because clearly, if King Charles is as ill as people say, there must be succession arrangements being made, and William may come to the throne rather sooner than he expected. Is that playing part of this? And as if someone like Christopher Guyte, who was the private secretary to the Queen, if someone like that was around, would he be knocking heads together and saying, look, we need to put out a united face?
Well, we all know what happened when Christopher Guyte tried to knock heads together. He got the heave-ho because Clarence House, Prince Charles, didn't like it. So I think people's abilities to knock heads together is pretty limited.
Right. And what do you think of the consequences of this? Will there be any change in behaviour? Will we continue to see people like Tina Brown speaking quite openly about problems, possibly constitutional problems, if the marriage is in trouble? Or will this just be tomorrow's fish and chips?
I think it will be tomorrow's fish and chips. And I question what... Look, the marriage might be in trouble. I suspect it's not, but it might be. But even if it was, I mean, we have been here before.
Yeah.
He wouldn't be the first to get divorced. So I haven't heard what Tina Brown has to say for herself, but I'm not sure what her argument is.
Well, I think she thinks that there's a bigger problem that's behind the scenes, and there's more going on than we've been told, and it's not going to die down. But you know, none of us know. I mean, even you with your contacts don't seem to know. Yeah. It's
of course,
to be
you know, look, you know, I no longer write for the Times, so I'm not in the daily business of keeping across everything that's going on in the Robb family. I'm writing a book, which is an entirely different kind of matter. So you know, I no longer have to keep in touch in the way I used to. Maybe Tina Brown knows something, or maybe she's just good at talking up a good story. I don't know.
Yeah, well, she's a very good journalist, so who knows?
I think both.
Yeah. This has been brilliant. Well, thank you so much. Yeah, well, for joining us.
It's really good of you to fit us in at such short notice when in a developing story. I mean, we're going to put this out on Monday, I think. Was it Sunday? Sunday or Monday?
Sunday night. Sunday night. We'll see.
Who knows by then? It could have changed completely.
Or you could be the voice of reason, as you often are.
Well, I don't know. Yeah. I just, you know, I'm not across it. I've no idea most of the time. But,
I think the interesting thing I've taken away from this is that actually this does all come down to Kate herself. She's probably powerful enough to be the one who's making the decisions. I don't want to be seen. I don't look my best. That's it. I don't care what people say. And maybe when it all boils down to it, that's what's driven this.
I see Kate's character. And if you look about the original, you know, releases about their different ailments, Charles, who's older and therefore kind of more relaxed, you know, he's comfortable in his own skin, and had a very good reason to put something out to, you know, for God's sake, I would have gone and had my prostate. I'd been meaning to have my prostate checked for ages. And then someone actually had, a friend of mine had his prostate removed. And I thought, oh shit, I better go and do something. And then about 4 days later, Charles went in hospital. I thought, okay, I'll make that call tomorrow. And I made that call.
Yeah, that was a good thing that he did. Very good.
Yeah, so he had a good reason and he's just kind of cool about it. Obviously, when they discovered the cancer, that was a different matter. But yeah, Kate,
not so. I mean, Kate, it's private, nobody else's business. Go away.
Yeah, and also, you know, I've got no idea what it could be because all my suggestions, when I tell them to medical friends, they say, "Yeah, but no, but you know." I say hysterectomy, and they say she wouldn't be in hospital that long. Wouldn't be recovered for that long. So yeah, I literally don't know, and I don't think anyone else does.
Yeah, well, and so of course, vacuum, you get all the speculation, and maybe you get it anyway. But you know, she's been hurt. They've had a fight. She's got a black eye. You know, or she needed a mental health break. All this stuff based on nothing but a couple of sad-looking photographs.
Yeah.
Well, I don't think it's going to change people's view of her. I mean, temporarily, but I mean, she, after all, in some ways, is carrying the future of the monarchy because she's probably the most popular member of the royal family. And it seems to me almost as a reaction against some of the speculation. I mean, more and more of the papers say, just leave her alone and let her get on with her life. Yeah. She's entitled to some privacy.
Yeah.
Do you think that's more likely to happen than people panicking and saying, gosh, we need to be more open?
Yeah, I think, you know, if and when she makes another appearance and starts doing some work again, and if she looks fine, if it's the old Kate, I think all this will be completely forgotten.
Well, let's hope it is.
And the next time they put out a picture, everyone will sort of jump onto it and remind us of the events of the last week or so. but the picture will turn out to be fine because there'll be idiots if it's not fine. And we'll move on.
Very good.
Yes.
Andrew's been faking his own photographs for years, haven't you, Andrew?
Well, I'm looking at with Prince Andrew, I'm looking at, you know, is the picture with Virginia Giffrey faked, as they're all saying. Yeah. So it's not a new story. You know, there's been a problem with fake photographs for a while.
It was fascinating when what was the PR called? You know who I mean? Who tried to put out that the picture was faked, rang people up, including myself, but I was too busy to take his call.
I know I get sort of 60-page documents sent to me with you know all sorts of arguments. There's clearly a very strong pressure being put on to dismiss this picture with Giffrey, because clearly they see it as an important part of the evidence.
Yeah.
But thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate it.
We do. And Valentine the Third, it's your third appointment.
Yeah. Yes.
Join a very elite group. There's you, there's Laura Thompson, I think Di Davis as well.
Yes, I think that's it. Yes.
Our threesome. Yes, the threesome with Phil and Andrew. Perhaps I.
Yeah.
Very good to see you, mate. Thank you so much.
Nice to see you. Cheers. Bye.
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 So there you have it.
Yes, the voice of reason. Maybe that is right. I don't know.
Maybe we're getting overexcited, but it's funny because, you know, he's not afraid to add the cat to the pigeons, is he, normally, Valentine? He wrote the book which revealed allegations of bullying by Meghan.
A very respected figure. I mean, who is trusted. So, you know, if he's saying this, maybe we should be pouring cold water on it. I don't know. Everyone's saying very different things.
Yeah, we mentioned Tina Brown earlier. I just reminded myself of what she'd said. You know, it's very easy to get on a Zoom, isn't it? And I think the Queen did that during COVID. Just get on a Zoom, some royal event, you know, for 5 minutes, just to sort of, that's something you could do from your bed if you're in your sick bed after is it 10 weeks since her operation? The whole thing is more and more mysterious. And as every day goes by, you begin to feel there's something else that hasn't yet come out.
It's amazing it hasn't come out in some ways, but you know, I think, you know, to cancel an appearance at your godfather's funeral where you're reading the lesson when you're 2 minutes up the road, 45 minutes to save personal reasons and not to give to amplify that is going to put the cat among the pigeons.
That makes you think it's not just health. Well, it's a form of mental health, perhaps, or relationship issues.
There's something, maybe something there. Well, also, you see, he's saying that, you know, the press office have basically shut down now. They're not answering questions. And, you know, this is just the time, in terms of reputation management, that you should be trying to change the agenda and get back in control and not let the control be taken by the trolls.
If they don't call Valentine, Andrew, you know, you've got the number. You could offer your services. What do you think?
Yes, well, who knows?
Maybe you that can have a rummage from the archives while you're there. It would
indeed. Win-win. I'll be nipping down to see what they've got on the Duke of Windsor. I found a wonderful piece the other day on the Duke of Windsor, which has never appeared before. He was staying with a man called Clint Murchison in Texas, who was involved with the Kennedy assassination. And he was so drunk, he collapsed in front of the door, and they didn't know what the etiquette was, whether they could step over him to get through the door or not. So, anyway. So, yes, the mystery deepens, or maybe it's been solved by Valentine. Who knows? We have to...
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
See what happens this week.
I guess talking of mysteries, we should return to what we advertised this program was going to be about, which is another fascinating story that we've been sitting on for a couple of weeks, actually. And I think the person, Robert, we're going to speak to is a friend of yours or a colleague of yours.
So maybe yes, he is. I mean, yeah, he's Robert Verkirk is an old author of mine. We tried to sell a book on Gareth Patterson shortly after Gareth Patterson, who was an MI6.
Gareth Williams, isn't it?
Gareth Williams. I keep calling him Gareth Patterson. Gareth Williams. Was found dead, locked up in a holdall. And Robert wrote, I think, a very good part of a book on this, which we didn't sell. But the story continues to rumble. There's just been an announcement in the press that a further inquiry has revealed that this is all very innocent and that he wasn't murdered. So it'll be interesting to hear what Robert's view is, because originally he thought perhaps the Russian mafia were involved.
Yes, well, from the tangled, complex world of the behind the scenes at the Royal Palaces to the equally tangled world of the Russian intelligence services, because this takes place around that time, I think, that they were first throwing their weight around, you know, poisoning people with Novichok and polonium or goodness knows what else.
Elsewhere. Well, we've got to remember it goes back a long time. There was Georgi Markov, who was killed with the umbrella on Waterloo Bridge.
That was poison, wasn't it?
So they had in fact, I did represent at one point a GRU agent who had been one of their poisoners sent into the West. So maybe we should get him back.
Rome's gallery of Andrew Loney's client list.
You're never going to. Someone once said, why did you come to me as an agent? I said to her, why did you come to me as an agent? She said, I put in sex maniac and agent, and your name came up.
Well, if I ever need anybody killing, disposing of. I know who to call.
Yes, exactly. I have several.
All right. Well, let's talk to Robert and see what he can tell us about the mysterious case of the man in the bag.
To have Robert Verkirk with us talking about...
Nice, Joe. How are you doing?
Very good. Thank you, mate.
Gareth Williams case, which is something we worked on over a decade ago. And there seem to be new things coming out the whole time. I mean, a new sort of inquiry reported only a few weeks ago. But can you tell us a little bit about Gareth Williams and what this story is about?
So Gareth Williams was a brilliant mathematician who won a scholarship to Cambridge University and was immediately picked up by GCHQ, the intelligence listening station in Cheltenham. And he was a protege agent, really, or officer, should we say. And then 10 years into his career, he was seconded to MI6 in London. And in August 2010, he went missing from the office for a week before anyone raised the alarm. When security services finally raised the alarm, sent the local constabulary to his flat in Pimlico, they discovered his body inside a North Face red sports bag in the bath. And that's where the mystery, the investigation, the story began, which has never really been solved to anyone's satisfaction.
I mean, what were some of the anomalies about? I mean, there was a big debate about whether someone of his size could actually put themselves in a bag like that, and people tried. But there's some evidence to say that you could do that.
Yeah, the evidence went both ways, actually. So at the coroner's hearing, an expert escapologist testified that he'd done it, I think, 100 times, and he'd failed to actually perform the same feat that Gareth Williams had done. He was unable to climb inside that bag and lock it from the inside. But another former police officer who was also expert in escapology said he'd done it, and he'd done it probably as many times and had managed it once. So it was never proven to anyone's satisfaction that it was an impossible thing to have done. There were many other aspects of the investigation and the evidence sort of adduced by the police and the family's barrister to show that something else might, someone, a third party might have been involved in getting his body into the bag.
But there were no sort of fingerprints. I mean, it looked like the whole place had been sort of cleaned up. I think people made the point that it just seemed unnecessarily sort of tidy.
Absolutely, yeah. The police said it, when they arrived on the scene, they said that it was as if someone had created the perfect kind of crime scene for them. They found his mobile phones on the table. The flat was completely tidy. The phones were returned to the factory settings. It was all, wonderfully laid out for them. So it was suspicious from the word go, but that doesn't necessarily mean it was, it was a malicious influence involved in his death.
Extraordinary thing, sorry, is that there was a long pause. He hadn't turned up to work for a long time. No one seemed to be doing anything. And then his sister reported he was missing, and there was a sort of missing 5 hours before the police were actually called, which suggests that MI6 may have moved in to look at the flat.
Yeah, I think the relationship between the police officers investigating the case and the role of MI6 in the investigation was unusual, to say the least. Even the coroner, Fiona Wilcox, said at the time that it was counterterrorism police who were in charge of the investigation because they had the clearance, they had DV vetting. So they were the officers involved in leading the case, but they didn't treat the MI6 officers, his colleagues, as witnesses in an inquest inquiry or a police investigation. So at no time were the written witness statements taken from the officers. They treated them like sort of helpful members of an agency. The relationship was too casual, which led to a real problem because MI6 clearly didn't disclose everything they had on Williams and some of his belongings. The police were eventually given, I think it was 9 memory sticks, which halfway through the investigation, where it might have been actually halfway through the inquest, suddenly turned up in his locker. And these were casually handed over to the police who were investigating. And the coroner said this was, extraordinary at that stage in the investigation that the MI6 had not given these memory sticks to them earlier.
And were there not attempts? All sorts of other anomalies.
There were all sorts of
smear him too.
Pardon, sorry.
Would they try to sort of smear him by leaking stories about his private life that would explain the death?
That's right. The whole thing got off to a terrible start because it began with day one. It was a civil servant was found murdered was found dead in his flat. And then, within day two or three, it was sort of sex game gone wrong, led to death of MI6 agent. MI6 agent wore women's clothes. MI6 agent was involved in dating people in Vauxhall gay clubs. This was all on the front page of the tabloid and other newspapers. In the first week of the investigation. So there was a sense that someone was trying to make sure that people got the idea that this was a sort of sex game gone wrong, or it was something about his private life rather than his professional life. And that's the way you could understand MI6 wanted it to be regarded.
What do we know about his professional life, Robert, that may have given somebody a motive to kill him? Do we know what he was actually working on in his sort of secret life as a sort of...
We know it. Obviously, it was secret, but we do know a little bit. He was a GCHQ officer seconded to MI6, and he would have been seconded to MI6 for a reason. But before he went to MI6, he was at the National Security Agency in Maryland, Washington, working with the American spooks. And he was working in, he was an expert hacker, or he was a counter hacker. So he knew all about mobile phone hacking. That was his expertise. Then he came back to London, and the rumours were that he was working on a live Russian money laundering investigation, and that had somehow led to him finding out something that was extraordinarily dangerous or delicate in relation to Russian intelligence.
And okay, so if anybody had a motive to get rid of him, it was our old friends with the Novichok and the Russian spies, well, who we know have been active in many places, including Britain, getting rid of people.
And very topical.
That's right. So, exactly, yeah. So that was theory number one. As you say, you know, the Russians have got form, Sergei Skripal, and the plutonium poisoning as well. Two, you know, very good examples of how the Russians can work against agents who present them with a threat. Or they would say, in both those cases, you would say that they were agents who'd betrayed Russia. This was very different. This was an agent or an officer who was a British citizen. And you have to ask yourself the question, this was a huge step for the Russians to assassinate a working British officer on British soil. It does rather beg the question, would the Russians have gone so far, and what would they have really gained from it? Was he really such a threat that it required such drastic action? Although one former officer told me that the way that he was killed was in the sort of shadowy worlds of intelligence and criminal underworld. It was a message. He was bagged and he was tagged, and that's how you got that. That's how the underworld gets messages across to the people it wants.
Because it was August, to be heard by, wasn't it? So I mean, but the heating was turned up, so this was almost deliberately to ensure the body would decompose. The fact that also it was in a bath, so any liquids didn't seep into flats below. It seemed like it was organized. But didn't a Russian KGB agent come forward in 2015, Boris Karpichkov?
That's right, Boris Karpichkov. I've spoke to him as well before, actually, in 2000 and I think it was 2012. And he was pretty sure that, and he's a former FSB agent himself, and he was pretty confident that the Russians were somehow involved in the killing. But he wasn't able to present evidence to prove it. He presented coincidental evidence. So he presented evidence of Russian registration plates in the vicinity of Gareth Williams' flat in Pimlico, which suggested that, you know, at the time or around the time that he disappeared, there were Russians in the vicinity. But it was more
a theory that he'd been, they'd attempted to recruit him and he had refused to be recruited. But also there were rumours that he had discovered a Russian spy at GCHQ, which might give a reason to silence him.
Yes, I mean, that would be it, wouldn't it? It's that kind of intelligence, or that kind of information, or that kind of investigation, which would make him the high valued target. But you'd need to ratchet it up to that sort of level before you get to the Russians acting on it. Before you get a motive running that says the Russians carried out this assassination.
But there's a long sort of story of people working with the Russians being assassinated in Britain. I mean, you know, the poisoning in Salisbury. There's Young going out of the window and being impaled. all these people dying in helicopter crashes, all the Russian oligarchs. I mean, there's form here.
Absolutely. If the Russians really wanted to do it, they're the only ones who are sort of capable of carrying out something like this. But as I say, Litvinenko and Sergei Skripal, they were both Russian nationals at one time. They betrayed the Russian state. They were considered traitors, and they were executed for that, or there were attempts to execute both of them.
Others were British businessmen who just happened to be working with the Russians, I mean, who had fallen out, whether with organized crime or with the FSB. So, I mean, it's not just escaped intelligence officers.
Yeah, none of these cases have ever been proved. I mean, the Young case, there was a history of drugs and mental health issues around his death. I'm not saying that the Russians didn't do it. All I'm saying is that the bar is very high for the Russians to carry out this kind of assassination of an MI6 officer working for the British state.
I guess if they were to go that far, it would need to be incredibly secret and deniable, unlike the other attacks, actually. And maybe that would explain this kind of effort to make it look like it could have been a sexual thing or a hiccup gone wrong. The private life of the man was shared. I don't know who shared it, why. Clearly did have an interest in bondage. He'd looked at various websites. Apparently his neighbours had once found him tied to a bed. Again, whether that's true or not, it was leaked by somebody. But of course, the Russians could have known that too. And they may have thought, oh, this guy's got an interest in this sort of stuff. This is how we do it.
He's more vulnerable, exactly, for sort of recruitment. But also, I remember the Stephen Milligan case. This was an MP who was a journalist on Sunday Times, who was uncovering all sorts of things. And he died in auto asphyxiation. I knew him from his girlfriend. And it was very unlikely that he liked sucking oranges and tying himself up. And there's a case of another investigator in Chile who was found hanging in a cupboard. I mean, there are a lot of these sort of stories of investigators who go too far and somehow a sort of shame. No one wants to pursue the story because of this embarrassing bit of their private life.
Yeah, no, that's good point. And you're right. They were onto something. If the Russians did it, then he had that kind of, private life background that they could use to their advantage. But a lot of this stuff came out in the inquest. You're right, he had been involved in acts of bondage, or I don't know whether you call it bondage, but he tied himself when he was in Cheltenham working for GCHQ. He was staying in a bedsit with a family, or rather an elderly couple. And one day the landlady had overheard some noises coming from his bedroom, and she'd gone and knocked on the door, opened the door, and there he was, tied to his bed. He said he'd tied himself to his own bed, but he was unable to free himself. So he was shouting out for help. So he clearly, this was independent evidence which showed that he was clearly involved in some sort of quasi bondage activity.
So, and I mean, women's clothes were found in his flat, and but then he'd applied for a fashion course, and there was a wig, wasn't there, on the back of a chair. Now, I mean, again, is this staged or is this just an insight into the private life?
Again, all the female high-end fashion female clothes, I think it was like £24,000 worth of clothes was part of his genuine interest in fashion. He was interested in fashion. I spoke to one of his friends who was a fashion designer, and she'd grown up with him in Wales, and she said that's ex- you know, she knew about the clothes. She knew that these were the things he was interested in. This wasn't new. This was part of his private life, which just happened to play into the hands of whoever, if there was a third party, whoever that third party was, you know, it played into their hands because they could use to disguise the sort of malicious element of his death.
I mean, by the time the flat was searched, properly searched by the police and the forensic teams, I believe they found no evidence that anybody had been there and anybody else, no fingerprints, no DNA. Of course, if they were extremely professional assassins, they maybe got rid of all that, but there has to be at least a chance it was just him and he was able somehow to get into that bag, I guess.
And there was sort of semen in the bathroom, wasn't there, suggesting there was, again, a sexual element to it.
Yeah, yeah. The fact that there was no... the idea that it was steam cleaned, I think, is the most suspicious aspect of the whole case, because why was it steam cleaned? Who steam cleaned it? What was the purpose of the steam clean? What steam clean wasn't completely 100% successful, because there were two DNA material relating to people who weren't Gareth Williams. And these two DNA particles were part of the police investigation. It was quite central at one point, but they were unable to, they were too weak. The evidence was too weak, and they weren't able to link them to any particular individual. But, you know, this was 12 years ago, wasn't it? This was, DNA investigations were, you know, have progressed since then. And that's why the police in 2021 reopened it, because they thought that new DNA technology would be able to unlock the key to these DNA samples. But as, you know, we found this year, a few weeks ago, that police had come up with negative in terms of both those samples. So as far as the police are concerned, that was the end of the investigation. But to me, it's still extraordinary that, you know, no DNA evidence has ever really emerged linking anyone else to that flat, not even any of his friends.
And the behaviour of MI6, it seems to me that, you know, there were people with security clearance from the police who were investigating, but the lack of cooperation from MI6, and there was a public interest immunity, which is basically a form that's signed, I think, at the inquest, where basically no one is allowed to know anything about the person. Seems that either he was a very important figure, or that somehow MI6 wanted to cover up what he'd been up to and possibly what had happened.
Yeah, no doubt there's much more to Gareth Williams and what he was actually involved in than we know and we may ever know about. And MI6 clearly had reasons to ensure that the public knew as little as possible. And I mean, in chasing that purpose, I think they got themselves slightly tangled up in the whole idea that this was a murder of some sort. And well, I think a bit more cooperation. It's not.
The inquest seemed to say probably a murder. Then the police investigation seemed to say probably not a murder. And that's kind of where it sits in terms of officialdom, isn't it?
It does, yeah. At the heart of this case is Fiona Wilcox's narrative verdict at the inquest, which found that the death was, her conclusion was, the death was criminally mediated, she said. And, you know, that's pretty, you know, for a coroner to go that far shows that there was enough evidence. She'd seen enough evidence. And remember, she saw evidence that the public didn't see. And she'd come to the conclusion that third parties were involved. The family's barrister, Anthony O'Toole, made a very strong statement during the inquest saying that they were convinced, the family were convinced that a third party using the dark arts had been involved in the murder of Gareth Williams. So that's pretty.
And is that your view? Is that your view, Robert? I mean, it's an impossible question.
Well, to answer.
Do you have a theory, best guess theory of your own?
Well, I was going to say, then the police, against that, you've got the police's, they're two separate investigations, and they both came to the conclusion that his death was a result of an accident, misadventure. And I was looking at it from the day of his death, 2010, and sort of on and off since then. I've interviewed probably more people related to or who knew Gareth Williams than anybody else. And, you know, some of them were very forthcoming and gave me a very clear picture of what sort of man Gareth was. And, and others were very difficult to find. And when you did find them, were very reluctant to talk to you and weren't sort of people you'd expect to be friendly with Gareth Williams. So, of all the cases and all the sort of stories and all the mysteries that I've investigated, this one is the most baffling by far. I really can't tell you. 12 years old.
At the time, I remember us talking about possible mafia involvement. This was Russian organized crime.
Yeah.
And that might also explain why it was, you know, he was bagged and tagged. It was making a statement.
Absolutely. That was, perfectly sensible way to look at the investigation. And probably, and that's the thing. It still is a sense, it still is a reasonable explanation as to what happened. Russian mafia money, it doesn't worry about things like, although of course Russian mafia very much part of the Russian state, but Russian mafia money in 2010, would have gone to these kind of lengths and may have taken the trouble of steam cleaning the flat and
All this was before Crimea. You know, the government at the time were quite friendly to Russia. The London laundromat was operating. Russian money was flowing into British life and British politics. You know, it was a time when the Russians probably felt quite empowered you couldn't walk around London for rich Russians driving too fast in Ferraris, I remember.
But also what I think is strange is, 13 years on, suddenly we've got this new inquiry that no one seemed to have known about, reporting. Why has it taken so long and why have they suddenly announced something literally in February this year?
Yeah, this was the DNA investigation it was the result of a Sunday Times story, which said that new DNA technology may be able to establish the identity of those people associated with those DNA samples found in the flat at the time. And the police took, 2 years to discover that they weren't able to get any further with the DNA investigation. And they, in fact, they sat on it because it was November last year that they finally found out that it wasn't going anywhere, but they sat on it for 3 months before they decided that they'd make that finding public. But the thing that I found with dealing with the police in this case was that always, they were never very helpful. They were always, I found them fairly obstructive. Sometimes they just wouldn't answer any of your questions. Things like why was the central heating on in the flat when he turned up? Did anyone find out who turned it on? Why was it steam clean? These sort of questions, they never answered. They wouldn't even provide a denial. And
I mean, what the company that steam cleaned it, were they ever found? And when was it steam cleaned? Weeks before his death or days? Do we know?
No, we don't. We don't. We don't know.
But there was a policeman, Sutton, who's appeared on television programmes, who was involved in the investigation. He's been quite critical of the Met.
Yes, yes.
It seems to me that, you know, say they weren't cooperating with you, but there's certainly even members of the team who are uncomfortable with clearly what was happening or happened.
Yeah, it does look like that. maybe there was a lot of pressure put on the Met, and you know, the decisions weren't being taken by investigating officers, but maybe decisions were being taken in Whitehall or in Vauxhall, maybe even. And you know, that would make police officers very uncomfortable about investigating a case like this, because you know there is a division of responsibility, and the police are completely responsible for investigating this a case like this. And if there was any sense that, you know, there were certain areas they couldn't go, or there were certain questions that they couldn't answer, then police officers would find that very uncomfortable. And I think that's why there was quite a bit of friction between the Met and SIS.
Gosh, I mean, it's an extraordinary story, and a mystery, as you say, may never be solved.
We love a mystery almost as much as a scandal. And I think this is probably, sounds like it's going to remain a mystery for a little longer, doesn't it?
Unless
I don't see how you ever solve it. The family will go to their graves believing that Gareth Williams was murdered. And, you know, and that's the saddest thing of all, I think, because they don't believe they've ever had any of their questions properly answered.
No, that is sad, and sadly typical when these sort of matters get sucked into the intelligence world. Well, thank you. It's a rather bleak conversation, but incredibly fascinating in a kind of gory way, I suppose.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, because, I mean, no one really knows this subject better than you, so maybe
we'll I think you do, Andrew.
Sorry?
Well, I think you do, Andrew.
Well, I've been following it with interest, and maybe one day we will get an answer. You can come back and tell us what happened.
You can finally sell the book.
Yes, that would be great.
Yes,
that would be great.
We all like a book deal. Thanks so much, Robert.
Thanks a lot, Robert. Good really luck. Nice to talk to you.
Love to speak to you guys. Bye.
Bye.
Well, case very much not closed.
Yes. No,
it's closed. Sorry, bad joke.
Yes, unfortunately, his case was closed. But, one of those great mysteries. And I think, again, you know, we see a coming Cold War. I was talking to an MI5 agent the other day, as one does, and he says there's a Cold War coming in a big way. Mm. So I suspect we're going to see more of these things.
All right. Well, what an episode. I'm exhausted.
It is. Yes, you can't say we don't offer you lives and spills here.
All human life is indeed here. I was going to do a quick review of comments.
Yes.
There's a lot of people have weighed in on this new policy we have of doing two shows a week. Alison Kent, who's been has commented before, and I think she may have bought a mug. Hi, Alison, if you're still watching. I really
like
two
shows a week. Yes, she's one of our great supporters.
Yes, she likes two. Colin McDonald thinks two shows a week are fantastic. You're the best podcast. Well, thanks very much. Who else? Nicoletta Sinchi has learned something new, as she does every week. That's nice. And Rachel Longacre has said the Wednesday-Sunday schedule is going to be a game changer. I'm going into Scandalmonger withdrawal by midweek, so this will have a stabilizing effect.
Good.
Yeah, that's nice.
We're getting to our rhythm. I wonder how people feel sometimes when we have two different interviews in a week. Is that too much? Should we just concentrate on one person, or does it add a little bit of variety to the show? Be interested to know what people think.
Well, I did the maths. It's we were normally getting 7,000 or 8,000 a week, and now we've gone to two. I think the last 7 days it's been 13. So right. It's not quite doubled, but it's almost doubled. And it's all the arrows pointing in the right direction. So thank you if you're one of those 13,000 people. Please subscribe on YouTube if you have not already, because it makes a huge difference. Keep liking, keep commenting, keep building the buzz.
Yes.
Next.
Yes.
Finally, we're doing Blood, I believe.
Yes, we're doing Blood. Factor 8, Jason Evans.
Yes, we spoke to Jason Evans a few weeks ago. We were sitting on that, rather. And it's another incredible story of, official malfeasance and very, very bureaucracy being really slow to respond to some terrible, I wouldn't say crimes, mistakes, really. Mistakes by officialdom, a bit like the post office scandal in some senses.
Well, there's so much. I mean, you see, I mean, the Scout Association are being sued because they lied in court. I mean, we've got a case with of someone who was killed and the family took 5 years to get any sort of justice. I mean, it seems to me that, you know, the criminal system is, legal system is breaking down and governments are just playing for time rather than paying compensation time and time again.
The next prime minister probably used to run the Criminal Prosecution Service in this country.
Yeah.
Mr. Starmer.
Yeah.
Secure, I should say. So maybe he will bring a new energy to this because something needs to change. Because these things drag on for decades. In fact, Jason's been fighting this for 30 years, and his own father was fighting it when he died, when Jason was quite young.
Yeah.
So that's what's coming up on Wednesday.
Yeah, looking forward to that. And we've got a couple of things. We're talking to another friend of mine, Richard Norton Taylor, who's a very respected Guardian journalist, who's also now been writing plays around various scandals in recent British history, particularly the Grenfell fire, which again is a big cover up, and still changes are not being implemented that should have been implemented there. A lot of people made a lot of money and are not really, in a sense, standing up to take account for their actions.
Okay.
But he's also involved in several other things, scandals. So
well, that sounds good. Many other things bubbling up, and I think we might even at one point get Lady Colin Campbell back. She's always good fun. On the more scandalous side of things.
Yes. Tell us if you like this balance of serious investigative stuff and sort of slightly lighter gossipy stuff.
Yes. And if you have a book to publish, just Google Sex Maniac Agent. It'll go straight to Andrew. Thanks for listening.
But until next week.
Until Wednesday, back. Bye.
Thank you for listening to the Scandalmongers podcast. This has been a Podcast World production. You can get in contact with our show by emailing team@podcastworld.org, placing Scandalmongers in the heading, or via our social media links within the show's bio.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.